1996 Sunstone Symposium welcomes you to session 352, Worthy of Imitation, Mormon Pioneer Women as Heroines in the Late 19th Century, by Jana K. Reese. Rebecca Bartholomew is the respondent.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Stacy Ford. I'll be chairing this session today. This is session number 352. It's entitled Worthy of Imitation, Mormon Pioneer Women as Heroines in the Late 19th Century. Our speaker today will be Jana K. Reese. She is going to be presenting her paper of the same name. She just told me that she is from New Jersey. She has one husband and a dog, and she is a PhD candidate in American Religious History at Columbia University. And she became interested in Mormon women's history when she was working with another paper that she was writing that involved the same subjects. And she's going to be reading her paper today, and if we have time, we'll have questions afterwards.
This paper that I'm about to read to you and present is an edited version of a seminar paper that I did for a seminar with Richard Bushman at Columbia University. And this topic of how pioneer history is remembered is something that I find very interesting, not only how it was remembered in the late 19th century, but also how it's remembered in the late 20th century. And I asked Becky Bartholomew, who's giving comments afterward, if she would kind of keep this in mind. And I'd like to gear the discussion afterward toward not only the content of the paper, but also how pioneer history is remembered now and what we're doing with it. And to that end, I wanted to take a look at just two songs that are in the children's songbook. I work in the primary, and these songs were being taught this summer in anticipation of Pioneer Day on July 24th. This one is called Pioneer Children Sang as They Walked. I don't know if anyone here is familiar with this. It's very repetitive. Pioneer children sang as they walked and walked and walked and walked are the words. And in our primary, the version was, pioneer children sang as they walked, yeah, right, yeah, right, yeah, right. And the other one is, pioneer children were quick to obey. And I think this is key. Pioneer children were quick to obey, walking along by the wagons all day, then in the firelight, kneeling to pray, little pioneer children. And the third verse, didactic, children today can be pioneers too, willing and cheerful in all that we do, walking in our pathway with heaven in view, little pioneer children. And I think this theme of how pioneer history is used for didactic purposes is helpful in understanding the context of this paper. Welcome to everyone who just came in. In case they didn't tell you at the door, this is not the Timothy Liu session, which has been moved to the market room. Yeah. Oh, bless you. Bless you. I explained earlier for Jane Ann and people who just walked in that this is an edited version of a paper that I wrote for a seminar in history, U.S. history with Richard Bushman. And I have tried very, very hard to edit it for presentation, but it's still a little bit on the long side. So I'm hoping when I practice this in my hotel room yesterday, I had it to 35 minutes, and I'm hoping that I can keep it to 35 minutes today so that we can have time for Becky's comments and also your questions and comments. So, with that said, George Orwell wrote that the person who controls the past controls the present, controls the future, excuse me. He observed a universal desire to create a usable past which would serve the needs of the present time. For Mormon women in the late 19th century, the quest for a usable past was undertaken with a subtle understanding of the challenges of the contemporary era. The women of the founding generation, those women who might have known the prophet Joseph or endured the exiles from Missouri and Illinois, were looked to as paragons of strength and virtue in times of crisis. Their stories were circulated, retold, and often embellished, but always utilized within particular historical contexts. In the 1870s and 1880s in particular, Mormon women were again facing persecution for their religious beliefs, especially for polygamy. Here, the legends of the founding mothers could be used effectively in similar scenarios of suppression as examples of what women should do: persevere, unite with the saints, and cling to their promise of eternal reward. However, the stories of the founding generation were also used by second-generation women in ways not directly related to their own experience. A widespread cultural retrenchment called by President Brigham Young encouraged women in the 1870s and early 1880s to forsake their worldly commerce and help the saints gain self-sufficiency. As an extension of this, another utilization of the first generation's legacy was as a didactic tool for younger women. Tempted by the ways of the world, and perhaps especially by monogamous marriage, such girls had to be lured back into the fold by magnificent stories of the sacrifices of their foremothers. Retrenchment and polygamy, therefore, were two issues in which the pioneer legacy was utilized to understand the current situation, both related to Gentile incursion into Mormon culture. Both targeted women in particular. As purchases for their households, women especially needed to retrench from patronizing Gentile commerce, and therefore women formed their own retrenchment associations, which emphasized home manufacture and economic autonomy. But as plural wives, women also had special concerns about preserving the polygamous lifestyle from the threats of American culture. Both retrenchment and polygamy, then, were issues that affected late 19th century Mormon women as women. However, a surprising facet of these Mormon women's use of their history is its gender inclusivity. Mormon women were not necessarily calling upon their history as women, but as persecuted pioneers. By the 1870s, a standard method of invoking the pioneer experience was already in place, and during the anti-polygamous persecutions of the late 1880s, that genre became even more normalized. The persecutions of the saints in Missouri and Illinois, the martyrdom of the prophet Joseph Smith, and the hardships of the westward trek became patterns for understanding contemporary subjugations. Throughout 1885, for example, the Mormon women's newspaper Woman's Exponent ran installments of three pioneer women's autobiographies. In the same February issue, Emily Dow Partridge Young wrote of her family's trials in Missouri in the 1830s, Patty Sessions recalled the persecutions of Nauvoo in the 1840s, and Helen Mar Whitney recounted the difficulties of the westward trek in 1847. All three authors provided a play-by-play enumeration of certain components being codified as sacred history: bitter persecutions, disease, famine, bitter cold, and ultimate exile. So in a single issue, readers were thrice reminded of their pioneer heritage and of the trials that the saints had endured. However, Young, Sessions, and Whitney were not calling upon a distinctively female past to help them understand the ordeals which women faced during the 1880s, especially regarding polygamy. All three women were, or later became, polygamous wives, but they remarked far less upon their own personal experiences of life in the principle than upon the unjust treatment of the entire Mormon people. Such emphasis upon common suffering served to underscore the need for unity when the Mormons were persecuted once again in the 1880s. I'm not attempting to document every instance of how the pioneer legacy was invoked to bolster polygamy or to understand retrenchment and sacrifice. I focused my attention instead on the pages of the Woman's Exponent, which was the female publication of the late 19th century and the early 20th century in the church. The Woman's Exponent first appeared in June of 1872, a publication by women, for women, and about women. It offers the finest examples available of Mormon women's ideas on various issues of the day. Alongside advice for infant croup and cornbread recipes lay opinionated editorials about women's suffrage, polygamy, and woman's sphere. Within these pages, Mormon women invoked the legacy of their forebears, often linking their legendary sacrifices to the problems facing the saints a generation later. In fact, the publication's first issues tied it consciously to a particular moment in the pioneer experience, the founding of the Relief Society in 1842. The women of Victorian Utah used the example of the powerful women's association of the past to lend some authority to the current enterprise. The Nauvoo Relief Society had first been sanctioned by the prophet Joseph Smith, and in a controversial decision, had been temporarily disbanded by Brigham Young until long after the saints had reconvened in Utah. Rather than criticize President Young or recall the period of the Society's dissolution, 1872 Exponent contributor Eliza Roxy Snow preferred to revisit the organization's brilliant first years, when the bitter cold and unhealthy climate of Nauvoo had threatened to decimate the saints. The Society had intervened, providing comfort and temporal relief from sickness and poverty. What is interesting here is that Snow chose to pass over the controversial adjournment of the Society and to resume the story in an unbroken line to the present. The exponent saw itself as a continuation of a powerful component of the pioneer experience. Significantly, however, more than a decade of that experience was omitted in women's consciously styled perceptions of their own history. In an effort to create a usable past, those elements of the pioneer legacy which did not present women as strong, active agents were jettisoned. This selective use of history raises the issue of how the women of Exponent perceived their own status, who was writing and who was being written about. Exponent's contributors were predominantly middle class, at least by Mormon standards, a factor which influenced their understandings of both retrenchment and polygamy. They were almost exclusively based in Salt Lake City, the most sophisticated of the Mormon outposts. They had access to some cultural entertainments, educational opportunities, and of course they had their own publication. Judging from some of the installments on domestic refinement in the Exponent, the newspaper's contributors were as engaged in Victorian understandings of womanly decorum as their Gentile counterparts were. They supported Frances Willard's temperance crusade and also her struggle for suffrage. They sought the calming influence of religious music in their homes, and they believed in the incalculable moral influence a mother exerted upon her children. Such concerns mirrored those of Protestant women, as did the emerging questions regarding women's sphere which the Exponent so readily engaged. The middle-class tenor of the publication, however, was tempered by some specifically Mormon concerns. Retrenchment, the church-wide program to encourage home manufacture in the 1870s, was geared to restrain the purchasing power of just such women as wrote for the Exponent, those who could afford imported silk, for example, or who might purchase a piano from a Gentile trader. There is some evidence that lower-class and rural Mormon women had a more difficult time relating to the expectations of retrenchment. Farm women had to economize all of the time, and retrenchment was primarily a middle-class phenomenon. Polygamy also was something of a middle-class concern. In contrast to the portraits painted by many Protestant reformers of polygamous families being completely destitute, plural marriage required a certain amount of capital to sustain. The practice had first occurred among elite church members and connoted a particular status. It encompassed those members who were loyal enough to practice it in the face of persecution, and also those who could financially afford it. Although one recent study suggests that the number of women involved in polygamy was higher than previously estimated, and may even have approached 40%, the authors concede that, quote, the data seemed to suggest that the practice of plural marriage was higher in wards containing the elite of Mormondom, unquote. Polygamy was stronger in affluent and urban Salt Lake City than in more remote areas. In effect, the women of Exponent, who were most likely to comprise this urban elite, were writing about their own situation in polygamy. The persecutions of the government hit them very close to home. Retrenchment and anti-polygamous legislation had a deep personal significance for these plural wives and middle-class consumers. Let's talk a little bit about retrenchment and what that meant. The 1869 extension of the Transcontinental Railroad into Utah seems to have spurred both the revival of the relief societies in 1867 and 68, and President Young's emphasis on territory-wide retrenchment. With the influx of Gentiles would also come a bombardment of their dry goods, including the most recent fashions from the East. Young discouraged all such trade with non-Mormons, since any capital spent on extravagances would reduce the community's financial support for its own temple and kingdom building. Instead, he wished to see the sisters engaged in home manufacture, the domestic production of all clothing, food, and goods in Utah homes. What followed in the 1870s, the years of retrenchment's zenith, was an unprecedented flurry of women's manufacturing activity. Rather than importing silk from afar, for example, Mormon women committed themselves to sericulture in their own barren land. Nearly 150 relief societies planted mulberry trees all across the territory and painstakingly cultivated their own silkworms in the 1870s. The Deseret Silk Association was established, quote, to disseminate information on silk culture, distribute eggs, and import facilities for the reeling of silk, unquote. By 1877, 5 million silkworms had been transported to Utah. Relief society leaders such as Zina Diantha Huntington Young traveled frequently to local chapter meetings to show women the luxurious silk items that had been crafted entirely in Utah. A handkerchief, a shawl, some gloves. The pages of the Exponent offered reader-to-reader advice on strategies for silk agriculture, and advertise the sale of eggs and equipment. Women also commenced to gather grain in the 1870s, so the Mormon community could prepare for possible famine and not be dependent upon Gentile civilization if disaster should strike. Brigham Young had chastised those Mormons who sold their grain to outsiders for a profit and encouraged them to store it for future community use instead. On an individual basis, however, Mormon farmers had disregarded this suggestion, so in 1876, Young requested that the Relief Society commandeer the project. Relief societies began to store grain all across Utah in buildings constructed with money most often raised by the women themselves, who in 1876 had consecrated $93,000 to charitable activities. In such home manufacture activities, the legacy of the pioneer was invoked to provide encouragement to beleaguered saints and to underscore the importance of unity. As Ina Huntington Young reminded the sisters, the Relief Society had originated, quote, with a few carpet rags, a little wool, and so on, but now they had spread and grown strong, unquote. Sometimes the remembrance of the early days struck a chord of gravity. One exponent contributor who had been an eyewitness to the terrible scenes at Nauvoo immediately followed her description of Mormon sufferings and her own widowhood with a brisk injunction, "Well, sisters, let us do what we can in the grain movement." Again, these women's non-gendered use of their history demands attention. A standard genre of pioneer experience is drawn upon but is not feminized. There is no connection, for example, of woman's work in retrenchment and woman's work in the pioneer period or the earlier days of Nauvoo. Women would consistently cite the persecutions of Missouri, the martyrdom of Joseph Smith, the difficult westward trek, and the hardships of making the desert bloom. But these were events that all pioneers participated in, not just women. The defeminization of the pioneer experience is a useful tool because some standardization of the legacy was necessary to make it more universally applicable. There are some intriguing parallels between this and a phenomenon that Sack von Berkovich describes as filiopietism. In The Puritan Origins of the American Self, Berkovich observes that Puritan exemplary biographies were intended to be archetypal. They served as an important transition from hagiography to modern biography, what we now know. Often, however, historical particularities were downplayed in the interest of universal moral relevance. The concept is useful in explaining the standardization of the pioneer experience. It becomes depersonalized and idealized to increase its value as a pedagogical tool for everyone. Redemptive history becomes critical to a people in the midst of transition. Transition is the key for understanding Mormonism in the 1870s and 1880s. If retrenchment acted to enlarge women's sphere, involving them in commerce and production, it also exerted a more restrictive hold on the younger set. Retrenchment had a significant pedagogical facet, as it extended to younger women and girls, who were sometimes criticized for their frivolity and predilection for small luxuries. As Blanche Beachwood complained in 1874 in The Exponent, Utah's young women, quote, feel disgusted with their home and surroundings and have an utter contempt for real life and everything domestic. They are dying to go to San Francisco or New York or someplace more stylish and more expensive. A little tatting to show off their white, delicate hands, elaborately ornamented with rings or some highly sensational novel, serves their purpose for enjoyment, unquote. To combat such indolence and pretense, retrenchment associations were organized to facilitate reforms in dress, diet, and spirituality among the younger women. The young women designed a costume to reflect the values of their retrenchment associations. Quote, conservative in comparison to the high fashion of the day, no furbelows, flounces, or ruffles, with skirts to boot tops, pantaloons beneath, and necklines to the base of the throat, unquote. In some communities, girls were taught to braid straw to make their own simple hats and trimmings. The older women wrote approvingly of the youth's decision to abolish round dancing across the territory in accordance with the suggestion of Brigham Young. The young women's sacrifices, however modest, contributed to the retrenchment cause. In the context of retrenchment, the overall stories of the sacrifices of the early pioneers became tools for moral definition, especially for that younger set. Rebecca Wareham, a sister from Manti, wrote an 1876 letter to the Exponent, which reminded her readers of, quote, the sorrows of Nauvoo. Yes, I saw their mangled bodies and the grief of that sorrow-stricken people, which was too deep for utterance, unquote. Wareham conceded that her purpose for writing was to, quote, keep in remembrance the past history of the church, that the rising generation may realize what we have had to endure to realize the blessings we now enjoy. She then closed by specifically admonishing her young sisters. "Do not get lifted up in pride, and follow after the fashions of those who are not of us," she wrote. Wareham sought to remind impressionable youth of the dangers of forgetting what their forebears had suffered. Such neglect might land them in the snare of the fashionable but foreign world. Their acceptance of those who are not of us might lead them to forget, or at least to reject outright, the sacrifices of the pioneers. So the pioneer legacy here was invoked as the standard to which contemporary youth should hold their own activities. In 1883, at the unveiling of the portrait Representative Women of Deseret, one contributor voiced her hopes that the painting might cause the younger generation to reflect upon their parents' trials, weighing those pioneers' sacrifices with, quote, "the poor temptations of the present time," unquote. Such tribulations were to be always at the forefront of girls' minds, especially in the context of their own small sacrifices during retrenchment. The pioneer legacy was seen as one of simplicity forced by persecution. Few material comforts had relieved the beleaguered early saints. In celebrating Pioneer Day, the July 24th anniversary of the Mormon entry into the Salt Lake Valley, participants reflected on their difficult yet triumphant past. One 1877 laudatory psalm called that the pioneers come not laden with gold, they come not decked with the glittering ornaments and splendid attire of worldly grandeur, but, although destitute of mammon's treasures, they come richly supplied with the more requisite capital for strengthening the stakes of Zion and building the temples of our God. Another Pioneer Day celebrant had recalled simply the many hardships of the first pioneers of the country, of the progress which had been made, of the duties of this generation born and reared under these circumstances, of the evil influences to be avoided by the young, and the responsibility which must eventually rest upon them. Pioneer Day celebrations were at least partly intended as instructional tools for youth and reminders of their noble heritage. Quote, "It is meet to celebrate the day with songs and rejoicing," one contributor noted in 1883, "and to teach our children that it is an epoch ever to be remembered by them as the birth of freedom to the oppressed," unquote. That Pioneer Day had a didactic purpose seemed clear in many local celebrations. In one community's parade, 24 old ladies, that's a direct quote, were decked out in costumes fitting the fashion of 30 years before. The girls in the Retrenchment Association, meanwhile, quote, "looked lovely, no long trains, but straw hats on their heads and white dresses, plain and neat and very becoming to the daughters of Zion." A general emphasis on purity and self-improvement eventually won the day over any organized effort to encourage girls and women in the wisdom of home manufacture. By 1884, the Exponent had to publish a plea for local relief societies to keep up with their sericulture because, quote, "nearly all interest in the matter has been lost," unquote. As the threat of the railroad dissipated and the persecution of polygamists accelerated into the 1880s, it was only natural that the retrenchment associations be disbanded in order to concentrate Mormon women's energies on preserving their very threatened family life. Retrenchment as a spiritual force and admonishment of the young continued throughout the 1880s and today. But the emphasis had markedly shifted to a focus on the quickened activity of anti-polygamists, both within and outside the fold. So now I'm moving on to the context of polygamy. I intended to have a brilliant little outline presented for everyone, but unfortunately my printer died at the last minute before I left home. Utah in the 1870s was the focus of overwhelmingly negative national attention, political and military pressure, and zealous reforming impulses which gravitated to the territory for one clear purpose. That was to eradicate the twin relic of barbarism. Excuse me. Do you ever look at a word and it's almost like you've never seen it before? I just looked at that word and I thought, wow. But you know, that was the point of that word, because the Greeks were trying to say that all of their enemies only spoke this language called bar, 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 bar. Anyway, the twin relic of barbarism, plural marriage, which persisted so stubbornly on the Wasatch Front. The pressure from the government was palpable, symbolized by the incarcerations of polygamous husbands and the various anti-polygamous bills pending in Congress, which threatened the confiscation of Mormon lands and property. In 1873 to 74, the Frelinghuysen Bill incited a flurry of protests among Mormon women, some of which were recorded in the pages of the Exponent. The bill, which would declare polygamous marriages legally void and the children of such marriages to be illegitimate, undermined the very foundations of the polygamous family. The bill threatened not only family and lifestyle, these women believed, but also the hard-earned suffrage and women's rights, which they so prized. Utah women had exercised suffrage since 1870 and had voted in all territorial elections. They proudly held to this as proof of their exalted position over American or Gentile women. Several editorialists noted throughout the 1870s that the various anti-polygamy bills pending in Congress specifically threatened to disfranchise Utah women, and these women had a good idea why. One wrote, "It seems to have been particularly the fate of the Mormons to be slandered, but until recently it was confined to men mostly, Mormon women being considered too low, degraded, and ignorant. Otherwise, they certainly would not live in plural marriage. Now a change has come. The franchise has been given to Mormon women, and they have been heard from. And as they will not give up the principles of their religion, which they know to be elevating and pure, they must needs be scandalized." Mormon women had been expected to use the vote to liberate themselves from the enslavement of plural marriage, but this had not happened. The sisters, proudly claiming the superiority of the polygamous lifestyle, had instead banded together and consistently voted as a Mormon bloc, further aggravating the Gentile authorities and the nation. Quote, "They said, give the poor, ignorant creatures the franchise," wrote one editorialist, "and they will turn the tables on their tyrants by pitching them into the big pickling tub nature has provided." "Well, our husbands gave us the right of franchise, showing how little fear they had of our vengeance," unquote. She expressed the bewilderment of the Gentile reformers who had said of the sisters, "We thought that they were fools, but found that they have outwitted us." Mormon women therefore used their franchise to preserve their lifestyle, demonstrating that they did not see themselves as being persecuted by polygamy, but rather by those who would seek to eradicate it. The sisters claimed that plural marriage, somewhat paradoxically, made women strong, and that for this reason it must be venerated. "Polygamy," asserted one enthusiast, "gives women more time for thought, for mental culture, more freedom of action, and a broader field of labor." Another polygamist wife claimed that, quote, "plural marriage makes woman more the companion and less the subordinate than any other form of marriage. Since women have learned to be self-reliant and self-sustaining and see their roles as loftier than being a man's pet or even his housekeeper," unquote. In polygamy, another editorialist claimed, "experience is gained, strength is developed, the power of governing is called into exercise, selfishness and self-ease are sacrificed, and the perfect type of womanhood is brought forth." Some scholars have suggested that on a practical level, polygamy encouraged women to share the labor of child-rearing, thus freeing them to engage in other pursuits. They also brooked minimal husband coddling. As one plural wife commented, "If her husband has four wives, she has 3 weeks of freedom every month." It would seem logical that their protestations about polygamy as a source for female strength might point women to cite the powerful examples of earlier plural wives, paragons of resourcefulness and righteousness. However, once again, the pioneer experience is invoked only universally. Women did not call upon the models of plural wives in particular, specific cases, but of Mormon suffering in general. Even when referring directly to polygamy, women employed a standard description of prior persecution over and above any discussion of the strength of polygamous pioneers. Perhaps one reason for women's defeminization of the pioneer past was that the gendered lines between men's and women's work had been blurred somewhat in polygamy. Because their husbands were absent much of the time, living with other wives or serving for years at a time on missions, women in plural marriage often had more independence and responsibility in traditionally male occupations such as farming. Other plural wives supplemented their incomes by more traditionally female labor, quote, selling farm produce, taking in boarders, washing clothes, or selling breadstuffs, quilts, or rag rugs, unquote. One plural wife wrote in the Exponent that in polygamy, quote, women are left to depend more upon their own judgment and to take more fully the charge of their own home and affairs. Such independence brings into requisition many latent powers in woman's nature, which would, under other circumstances, have lain dormant, unquote. Despite the women's active attempts to persuade outsiders that they were committed to the polygamous lifestyle, or perhaps because of them, the efforts of anti-polygamy crusaders increased. In 1879, the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision in Reynolds v. the United States, which outlawed Mormon polygamous marriages, preparing the way for laws in quick succession to imprison all Mormon males found in unlawful cohabitation, and ultimately to disincorporate the church and seize its property. It is in this context of accelerated anti-polygamist activity that the stories of the founding generation begin to appear in the protests of Mormon women. Many women saw parallels between their enemies' current tactics and those of the early period when gross indignities were heaped upon the saints in Missouri and Nauvoo. Sarah Rich, a pioneer from those days, recalled that her husband had been shot at before her eyes, her house mobbed and plundered, and a gun held to her head. She wrote in 1876 to Mr. Christensen, who had introduced a measure of anti-polygamy legislation in Congress, that Mormon women who had endured such persecutions would neither submit to polygamy if they did not think it best for themselves, nor allow interlopers to persecute them once again. Blanche Beachwood also queried if Mr. Christensen thought that, quote, Mormon women will just sit tamely down and be dispossessed of their rights, rights earned, if not inherited, by peril, by toil, and by sacrifice, offered up with bleeding hearts, murdered prophets, starved and ill-clad children, plundered homes, untimely deaths of fathers, mothers, brothers, sisters, babes, and friends. And for all these 10,000 wrongs recorded in the annals on high, there is no redress for Mormon women. And even if this is not enough, men must concoct bills to push them to their last extreme. Unquote. Many women expressed anger that instead of seeking to make reparations for its previous crimes against the Mormons, the U.S. government was seeking to persecute them once again. Some called upon the stock description of pioneer suffering to underscore their point. After describing some of the saints' early trials, one woman chided, quote, far better would it be for you, Gentiles, to hang your heads in shame and seek in all humility to make reparations for the wrongs already done to this people than to seek up strife, to stir up strife and hatred against them. The editorial closed on an ominous note, promising destructions to any who dared to lift his hand against Zion. Some women saw anti-polygamous legislation as simply a lofty pretext for a more base anti-Mormon annihilation. In Missouri, one woman observed, polygamy had not been at issue, and still the saints were driven from their homes without redress. Politicians and anti-Mormonists today, she wrote, quote, think themselves better provided with a pretext than our former persecutors were, since they have now a great hobby horse on which to ride called polygamy. Another sister explicitly connected the sufferings of the pioneers to those of her day. Quote, many have wondered how such outrages could be perpetrated in the states of Missouri and Illinois 40 years ago, when lo, here they are being enacted right again, right in the blaze of our advanced civilization and enlightenment, unquote. Such protestations did little to assuage the accelerating tempo of anti-polygamous persecution. Church President John Taylor claimed that a legacy of tyranny was indeed repeating itself. In his Pioneer Day address of 1885, he recounted the many sufferings of his fellow pioneers who, quote, came here as exiles 38 years ago, driven from our land and homes, our temple and city of Nauvoo, unquote. Although their enemies had plotted for their destruction, the Mormons had persevered, only to once again be victims of persecution. On that Pioneer Day, Taylor recounted, families are dissevered and broken up. The most sacred ties are rent asunder. Homes are made desolate, and many of our leading men languish in prisons among thieves, murderers, and criminals of the worst description. Our cities, towns, and villages are infested with spotters, deputy marshals, informers, and all those questionable characters. But Taylor concluded on a hopeful note. When reflecting on the past 38 years, he said, the saints had great cause for rejoicing, just as God had rescued them in former times. He said that in our present trials we shall have a similar experience. What remained was for the saints to unify themselves, continue in harmony, and not speak evil against plural marriage. This theme of unity, especially concerning plural marriage, is the key for understanding how Mormon women use their pioneer history. An example of this can be found in the exponent obituary of Emmeline F. Young, a wife of Brigham Young, who, of all people, would have tasted the difficulties of the polygamous life. First acquainted with celestial marriage at Nauvoo in the early 1840s, Mrs. Young endured not only persecution from the outside world, but also from the ranks of the saints themselves. She persevered with what the obituary lauded as, quote, purity of feeling and earnestness to do the will of God, unquote. She was among the Mormons who were driven from Nauvoo in the dead of winter and crossed the Mississippi River on the ice. Despite her suffering, she remained true to the faith and to the principle of celestial marriage. And in the exponent, celestial marriage is capitalized, presumably for emphasis. She strictly enjoined her children never to speak against the principle. The obituary demonstrates how Mormon women used the legacy of a past generation, a polygamous generation, to sustain themselves in their persecutions by an unsympathetic government. Celestial marriage still needed to be supported by the kinds of sacrifice that Emmeline Young seems to have given so willingly. for it was in danger of extinction. Persecution, so rife in Nauvoo and Missouri, had now reared its ugly head in Utah. Emmeline Young's warnings that her children never publicly contradict the principle of celestial marriage is significant. The need for unity in the Mormon ranks was often reiterated by polygamous women of the period, as demonstrated by their remarks to young girls, never to speak evil against plural marriage. In a negative way, this emphasis can also be seen in how Emma Smith was remembered in the pages of the Exponent. Like Young, she was also a woman who endured the persecutions of the saints and ultimately laid everything in the altar when her husband Joseph was martyred in the Carthage Jail. Emma, as the first president of the Relief Society, could have been used as an exemplary Mormon heroine, except that her anti-polygamist murmuring turned to alleged apostasy when she refused to follow Brigham Young as her husband's successor. Emma was remembered not for her accomplishments or for her outspoken feminism, so prized among the Exponent coterie, but for, quote, using her influence to pervert the minds of the sisters and set them against plural marriage, unquote. The bottom line seems to have been the support of polygamy. Again and again, women were lauded in Exponent obituaries for enduring the trials with patience and commitment to the principle. Emma Smith was an exception who instead was counseled that, quote, women in these associations should not use their position and power to pervert good. If they do so, evil is sure to follow and come on their own heads, unquote. As Emily Young, a Charter Relief Society member, later recalled, Emma often made things very unpleasant. While Young did not blame Emma for despising polygamy, she seemed to regard her as an example of what not to be. Emma was an outspoken dissenter, whereas Emily Young prided herself that she had, quote, never repented of the act that made her a plural wife, unquote. Emma was the example not to follow, and unity was the key. Mormon women's use of history, therefore, varied according to purpose. The widespread persecutions of polygamous Mormons in the 1880s necessitated an intense group loyalty and cohesion, which in turn resulted in a defeminized and universally applicable pioneer history. With a standard experience of persecution to draw from, Mormon women were able to articulate the similarities between their own situations and that of previous subjugations. So far, the Almighty has preserved his people, one editorial said comfortingly. Then again, it added, that history is repeating itself is nonetheless clear. The corollary to George Orwell's quote, that the one who controls the past controls the future, is that the one who controls the present controls the past. For Mormon women in the late 19th century, Exponent served as a means to subtly shape and understand that past. Through the vehicle of their own newspaper, late 19th century Mormon women used the past to influence their present circumstances and to mold the rising generation. Pioneer heritage informed these women's identity and remained an example for them to follow in times of crisis, but their present circumstances determined how that past would be reconstructed. Unity was perceived as the fundamental strategy of persevering against an oppressive government, and the focus on retrenchment and support for polygamy reflect that strategy. History was used to serve a mighty end, that of unity in oppression. As such, Mormon women's pioneer heritage lost some of its immediacy as lived experience, especially for the women of the Exponent. Their pioneer legacy was defeminized and often depersonalized to underscore its applicability to an entire Mormon society. That legacy was, however, still very real. In an 1883 visit to Nauvoo, Louis Wells wrote her mother that she had seen the river town, now abandoned, and felt the tangible presence of her mother's generation. I thought of your sufferings, how perhaps you had gone through these same streets, and of all the sorrow and trouble you had known right there when you were so young, she confided. It seemed as if you must be there, and I would turn around to look. Thank you.
Becky Bartholomew is going to come up and give a few comments.
I really need to get bifocals here. If I'm interpreting Jana correctly, in fact, I'm just going to have to take these off so I can see if I'm getting too old to be doing this. She observes that pioneer Mormon history as written by its women is very much like pioneer Mormon history as written by its men, and she wants to know why this is so, or was so, and how it was so. And she concludes that in Utah, I hope I'm not oversimplifying, but I think I'm boiling it down, that in Utah, the LDS community ran into adversities that brought forth the same response that the Missouri persecutions brought forth. That is, loyalty and unity above all else. And this carried over into the writing of their history and their autobiographies. And the adversities that Jana names that they encountered in Utah were Gentile encroachments, both economic and cultural, and the anti-polygamy campaigns. Okay? And Jana has asked me to respond in certain... She asked me several questions that she'd like me to deal with, and I hope that I deal with these for her. My first response is that her paper is very interesting and that her findings are going to be very useful, not just in understanding pioneer women, but in understanding some of the roots of today's cultural attitudes in Mormondom. So I really got quite excited about it, and I hope I don't... And I'm sure you are, too. I hope I don't take away from some of that excitement. Then my second response was that assuming Mormon women's history was defeminized, to emphasize those same three elements that men's history emphasized, why those three elements? And that puzzled me for quite a while. Third, could there be another explanation for the defeminization of Mormon women's history? Not instead of, but besides, as an outgrowth of retrenchment and as a response to the anti-polygamy actions. So I would like to start with that third question and pose, not as an alternative theory for why they might have defeminized their history, but as an additional factor, and that is simply frontiering. That the frontiering experience blurred the lines between men's and women's roles. And in Mormonism, this blurring was accentuated by the fact that the men were often away on church and community business. Women's exponents. So let me go through a couple of those again. August 1876. Polygamy gives women more time for thought, for mental culture, more freedom of action, a broader field of labor. Here's another one, September 1877. Plural marriage makes women more the companion and less the subordinate than any other form of marriage, and I'm paraphrasing here, since women in polygamy have learned to be self-reliant and self-sustaining. Okay, here's one from 1984. In polygamy, experience is gained. Strength is developed. The power of governing is called into exercise. Selfishness and self-ease are sacrificed. And the perfect type of womanhood is brought forth. The perfect type of womanhood is brought forth. Now, the Victorians had what we like to call the cult of the true woman or the cult of the natural woman. And in this cult, Victorian women were to be... I don't think they used this word, but as you read the Victorian literature and the Victorian manuals, you have to put sweet as the first characteristic of the ideal Victorian woman. Sweet, gentle, motherly, wise, modest, meaning both private and domestic, supportive of her husband, and spiritually inclined. That's the Victorian ideal. What words did Mormon women use to describe their ideal of womanhood? Mentally cultured, free acting, having a broader field of labor, self-reliant, strong, possessing governing power, and we could add to this some others that aren't in these particular quotes, loyal, God-fearing, industrious, resourceful, intelligent, non-materialistic, a very different ideal of womanhood than the Victorian cult. And not that they rejected the Victorian qualities, but that they added to them and then emphasized the ones that they added and not the ones that they had added to. An offshoot of this question is, but was this new ideal of vital, capable, intelligent womanhood a product of polygamy or frontiering? And my guess is that it would be both. And I say this because of my study of what happened to 100 British immigrant women went on the Utah frontier in the 1800s. Now, many of these women were pretty audacious little bodies before they ever got here. But as you study their histories and the autobiographies and the biographies of them, you begin to see a toughening and expansion of outlook, a growing confidence and self-respect among them as a result of their frontiering experience. And this applies not just to those who lived in polygamy, but those who were in monogamy, and not those who came to Utah as young women, but as those who came to Utah in maturity. So I just find that it's a result of the frontiering experience as much as the polygamous experience. Now, as further evidence of how frontiering affected even a middle-class urban, i.e. Salt Lake City pioneer couple, I would like to point to the journal of Catherine Myring Woolley, She began writing this journal in 1849, which was 7 years before her husband took a plural wife, so we can rule out polygamy as a factor in their experience at this point. It's a very precise diary in which she defines their daily activities. Almost every day, very seldom does she miss a day. And it shows that, yes, Catherine and Samuel did tend to divvy up responsibilities according to gender. For instance, Catherine did the cooking and the baking and then the shopping and the laundry, the vegetable gardening, the chicken and goose plucking, and virtually all of the child care. I only found one exception in 3 or 4 years where Sam was supposed to babysit, but he didn't get home in time, and so she missed her meeting. Samuel, on the other hand, did the log hauling, just what you would expect, the wood cutting, the cabin building, the plowing, the horse and cattle tending, most of the attendance at meetings, and screwing around at the fort. My word, but her sentiment. I think I'm taking her the way she meant it. I think she meant it sardonically when she wrote one time in her diary, "Samuel went to the fort 3 times today." But this arrangement, this separation that they made of their roles was not formalized. Every task they did was a joint effort, and it was done to further their joint homesteading effort. Not his job, his career, or her project, or his career, not his role or her role, but their role, their cabin, their lot, their farm, their herd, their extended family, their Christmas party, their mutual survival. And fairly often they worked together on tasks. For instance, he cut out the window frames to the cabin and she set the window panes. He minced the mincemeat and she seasoned and baked the mincemeat pies. He carried the furniture out of the cabin so that they could have the Christmas party there, and she scrubbed the floor and baked the pudding for their Christmas party. They did what came naturally in homesteading, and they stood in for one another when the partner was ill or gone. Their roles were ad hoc, and I suspect much more intertwined and mutually centered on the homestead than was generally the case with Victorian and post-Victorian marriages. Thus, it seems feasible to me, and I hope I'm not taking too big a leap, that Mormon women wrote pretty much the same history as Mormon men because they experienced pretty much the same thing. And actually, except for the Relief Society, their only exclusive experience was labor, birth, and nursing. And no Victorian women, not even Mormon women, talked about that sort of thing publicly, or even in their diaries. I only found one instance in all the diaries that I looked at of a woman who talked about menopause. Nobody talked about sex. Okay, next question. Why those three elements? Why the Missouri persecutions and the martyrdom and then the trek across the plains? And I brainstormed and brainstormed, and I just really couldn't come up with some definitive answer, so I asked myself, why not those three things? Take the Missouri persecutions. They really were the first widely shared Mormon persecutions. The experience in Kirtland, first, the church was quite small then, membership limited, and there were ambivalent circumstances in Kirtland, not clear-cut, unadorned oppression and malevolence like we found in Missouri. Why the martyrdom? And for reasons that I'm not sure I can understand without being a 19th century convert, the death of Joseph Smith had a truly traumatic impact on pioneer Mormons. You can see it in scores of pioneer journals, including those who had not come to Utah yet or to Nauvoo and had never met Joseph Smith. It brought people back to the church who had been wavering. It stopped dissensions for a considerable time. It catalyzed commitment. It even reunited some couples who had separated. It was a traumatic and a splitting event, a catalyzing event. But I'm not sure why. And then what about the Plains trek? Again, I'm not sure it's possible to recreate a 19th century member's mind, but we'll try. It may be that the trek experience struck a chord in these pioneers who were very literal biblicists. Most of them took the ancient Israelite history literally. It may be that traveling together for 4 months, and this doesn't even include the sea voyage for those who crossed the sea together, sleeping on the open ground, sharing food and fires and watering holes and children, unified and bonded people. It may be that following a trail that was broken earlier by another company led the later people to identify with those who came before and after. It may be that traveling out in the open under the stars with clear air and touching every foot of soil along the way and coming face to face with the birds and rabbits and snakes and buffalo for 15 long, tedious weeks and sometimes longer than that, leaving everything that was familiar to you and going into the unknown, and the only thing you have to hold on to is each other, not knowing whether and how you were going to survive as a family once you got there, that it just made an indelible impression on white folks' minds. People who had previously lived behind brick walls, even if it was in a tenement slum, under slate roofs, shielded by glass windows, with beds and mattresses and pillows and corner shops to go to. After you arrived in Utah, you went many different directions, so that the crossing was the one funneling experience that was shared by three different generations. Three different ages of people, those who came in their older years, those who were young, and most of the people who crossed the plains were in their 20s and 30s, and those who were children at the time. Even those who crossed the plains by train after 1869 could just look out the windows and see where some poor soul had had to walk every mile of the way. And even we who crossed by auto in 1996, as we go across mile after mile, tedious mile of Wyoming and Nebraska, we look out the window and I don't know that there's any of us who don't think, oh my God, they walked. Or they stood behind a smelly ox all the way. So in other words, the plains was a gateway, and I believe that it became a unifying experience for those first three generations of Mormons, an initiation ritual almost, in the individual and the collective heart, and an experience so impressive that they didn't want it to be forgotten. They wanted to pass it on to their children and their grandchildren. Now, that's not very intellectual, and I don't think it answers Jenna's questions, but I'm so excited about what she said, I don't care. I think it does add to the understanding of what she's saying, and I want to thank you again, Jenna, for what you did for us.
I'm sorry, I don't think we have enough time to field questions, but I'm sure you're welcome. We've got 4 minutes? Okay, 4 minutes to field questions. Go ahead.
Self-serving.
Uh-oh. This always gets me in trouble.
Retrenchment and all of, are we doing it now?
With retrenchment.
Mormons are the most conspicuous consumers in the world. Let's them never awed by the things that we collect. And, I mean, even the people who were supposed to be setting an example have the biggest houses and the biggest cars, etc.
I see your point. I was talking more about spiritual retrenchment in my experiences in working with the young women was the context in my mind. This being a didactic tool for their spiritual regeneration. Oh, for the tape, the question was calling me to task about something that I said kind of as an aside about retrenchment continuing even today when Mormons are, and I totally agree with you, such conspicuous consumers. And so that's an excellent point. I think what I was referring to is much more the kinds of spiritual values that we're trying to inculcate in the young.
Yeah, you're saying that we really don't do anything
about material, right? Right.
Yeah.
No, not in that way at all. I don't even think food storage counts. Okay. Other questions?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad you asked that question, because actually I wanted to bring this into my paper, and I could not think how to do it. The question is about how pioneer stories serve to function today, and I'm interested in this because I think it's actually quite different. Yesterday I found this article from the most recent issue of Sunstone, and it's by Christine Durham, who is an Associate Justice of the Utah State Supreme Court. Her husband is a descendant of Susie Young Gates, who was a daughter of Brigham Young. And she has outlined here quite a bit of Susie Young Gates' autobiography, and some of it is very career-oriented. She is careful to list all of the professional accomplishments before the personal ones, and I think that that is significant in how women are using history today. But what I found especially interesting is right at the end, she brings up two points of Susie Young Gates' life that I think are significant for today. One of them is that, quote, she often administered to her children and grandchildren when they were ill and blessed them in need, as was common for Mormon women in those days. Now, what's that about, right? Okay, that is our contemporary struggle of women fighting for some kind of spiritual authority in the church, whether it be the priesthood or more informal authority. The other thing is, lest we lose touch with the real humanity of this remarkable woman, let me note, in addition to losing 8 children Sousa experienced divorce from her first husband in a time and place when divorce was nearly unthinkable, and she was separated from her two children of that marriage for much of their early lives. She suffered what we would probably call a nervous breakdown, brought on by exhaustion, overwork, and grief. Sounds familiar. In the early part of a century, she lived the hectic, overburdened life of every mother of young children, as described in this excerpt, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so here we see that the woman is picking out just this current contemporary struggle of trying to balance career and family. So I think what people are choosing from pioneer history today is extremely indicative of our own experiences as women today. And I think that, ooh, a whole paper, a dissertation, a book needs to be written about this. I'm not the person to do it, but I think that, and also we see this in the movie Legacy. Mom and I just went to see this again the other day. And the way that pioneer history is remembered in Legacy, well, first of all, it's entirely monogamous, right? There's no depiction of polygamy in that film whatsoever. It never happened. For the tape, Jane Ann says that also the heroine has big fake boobs. So, okay, what does that tell us about history? But it's an excellent question, Mary Ellen. Excellent question. Do we have time for one more?
We don't.
We don't have time. Well, thank you all very much for coming. I really appreciate your comments.
We'd like to thank Jana Reese for her insightful paper and Becky Bartholomew for her insightful comments afterwards. I'm sure that you're welcome to ask questions afterwards. She'd be happy to answer them for you, and I'd like to encourage you to attend the other sessions of Sunstone. Thank you.